He's just a mummy roaming around Great Britain.
Sir Philip is sleeping. M'lady, he's bleeding. No, he's not.
I love your Queen Elizabeth impression.
His Thanks. Kidney is just hanging out. They're like, honey, tuck that back in.
Philip, please.
How indecent.
It is season two now, season dose.
Woo.
I hope you enjoyed the first episode, because we put a fuck ton of work into that.
More than any episode ever, probably.
I spent days slaving over my laptop, editing and putting together that episode. I hope
we
you
watched
like it,
movies. We made a timeline, which you saw on all of our social media.
It was really worth it, though, honestly. It was really fun to do and put it together. So I hope you guys liked it, because we really liked it. Anyway, I am your host and spiritual guide, Sean Barber. I am joined by our resident expert in death, Miss Nicole Jewett.
Hello, everybody.
And the man who knows nothing, Mr. Ethan Black.
What's poppin'?
How are you guys feeling about season two so far?
We hope you're feeling good, because I'm feeling good.
Yeah, I'm feeling dandy about
it. You like it? All right.
It's going well.
So today's episode is all about people who have faked their deaths, including a serial killer, a World War II double agent, and one of the weirdest men to ever grace the face of this planet.
Houdini?
Okay. Stay for the last story. It'll be the craziest thing you've ever heard. And if it's not, I will eat my shirt. Like, just send us a DM that it wasn't the craziest thing. I will post a video of me eating my shirt.
I feel like we're a clickbait BuzzFeed article.
For real.
You won't
Wackiest
believe the last story.
Not clickbait.
A crazy story in my area? It's more likely than you think.
After listening to this episode, go find us on Instagram at RuleOf3333 and on Facebook at the Rule of Three Podcast. We've actually been posting a lot more.
Yes,
so there's
we have
interesting stuff on there that you'll want to see. Also, don't forget to leave a rating and a review. We'd really appreciate it. And just thank you for listening in general. Mm-hmm. It's so nice of you. It's just so kind.
I also feel like we should mention, because we didn't mention in the last one, that we have a theme song now.
Yes, we do.
We recorded that after we recorded the episode, and so we didn't mention it at all, and I feel like it just kind of came out of left field, and people were like, whoa.
It completely did. We went into the studio one night for 4 hours to get 30 seconds of audio. Which was worth it. It was really fun, but I hope you guys like it.
But I just wanted to acknowledge that that exists now, so you guys aren't like, what the fuck?
All right, we ready to get into this one?
Yes.
We're ready.
All right, let's do it. We've got three dumbass hosts, three crazy stories, and no fucking clue what we're doing. This is Rule of Three. Mr. Ethan, play me something smooth, baby. No, not a cough.
I think it's physically impossible for our harmonica to be sexy, so I think that was a good try for what you had to work with.
Can you imagine somebody trying to seduce you with a harmonica? They're just like, hey baby, I wrote you a little ditty.
That'd be hilarious.
All right, so this episode has a couple caveats that we need to discuss before we get into it.
Ooh.
Because it's about people faking their deaths.
Uh-huh.
So these stories are mostly going to be about the people themselves, with them faking their death part. That's going to be a little shorter, because there isn't a ton to talk about in regards to them dying.
It just kind of happens, and they either get found out or they don't. So,
because the people that are best at faking their deaths, you're never going to know about it.
Yeah.
So
as far as you know, they're dead.
Like Houdini.
And Tupac.
And Elvis. Elvis is still alive, apparently.
No, I think he died from lung cancer.
Okay, that's good.
I think that's confirmed. Yeah. Cigarettes really get you.
So the people that are best at faking their deaths, we can't talk about, because we don't know that they faked their deaths. So that's kind of the issue with this episode. I still think we did a pretty fun job, though.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
So here are the fake death rejects.
Pretty much.
So this episode is more going to be about the people, how they got to that point, and the aftermath of them faking their deaths. I also want to talk a little bit about the history of people faking their deaths, how it goes down, and why people tend to do it. People have been faking their deaths since the beginning of time, honestly, and it's become really popular in media today as this, like, fantastical end-all be-all escape plan that can get you out of any situation.
Which I don't understand, because how can you just be like, my life sucks, damn, I'll just pretend to be dead. That'll fix it.
It's a lot harder than you think, though. It's hard to do it successfully. It doesn't work out the way that people tend to think that it works.
Yeah.
So the most common reasons for faking your death seem to be insurance fraud. Uh-huh. You got to get that money. Mm-hmm. Getting out of massive debts or legal problems.
Of course, the mafia.
Mm-hmm. For safety reasons, if your life is in danger.
Like witness protection type shit?
Well, yeah, I mean, kind of. Like if you think that...
Like if the mafia's hunting you down... You pretend to blow your brains out.
Yeah,
so
for like political reasons, if you think someone's going to assassinate you.
Yeah, you
which
would.
Has happened.
Yes, it has.
Not assassination, but like people faking their deaths because they think they're going to be assassinated.
Well, assassinations have also happened.
Yes, that too. Yes,
ask Abraham Lincoln. He would know.
I don't think you can. You need a Ouija board for
Martin
that.
King Archduke Ferdinand, that's his name.
Mm-hmm. He got fucked big time.
Yeah, he sure did.
He really was a little full of himself, though, causing... big old war and everything.
Can you imagine?
Little bitch.
Donald Trump gets shot and it's all of a sudden, it's all about him.
Not everything is about you, Fred. And most people also fake their deaths just to get out of a shitty situation they're in.
Marriage.
Wife bad. Yes.
Wife bad.
Or husband bad. Or abusive. I watched a movie on that, and it was pretty damn good.
On abusive husbands?
No, on a, well, abusive husband, like, boyfriend thing, and then she left and faked her death.
Oh, that's cool.
What movie was it? Do you know?
It's on Netflix. Oh, it's called Hidden in Plain Sight. If you have a Netflix account, watch Hidden in Plain Sight. It is very good.
Yeah, okay. I want to see that.
She pulled, actually, one of the first things that we talked about, where she walked to a bridge and then just parked her car. And then walked off with a suitcase, and they were like, oh,
just
she's dead.
Like the Black Dahlia's dad.
Yeah, look at that.
A little bit throwback.
Damn.
So the easiest way to seamlessly disappear is through faking a water-related death. Yeah.
I mean, makes sense.
So, like, drowning, jumping off a bridge, like we said, you know, you like, park your car, they jumped off a bridge.
Yeah.
Sailing away on a boat, never coming back. And the reason that tends to work is because it's very hard to find a body in those cases. Anyway, the police don't always expect to find a body.
If your body's
like
in the bottom of the ocean, chances are no one's going to find it.
Especially when it's like
moving
water.
And it's going to get eaten by fish and then you're just gone.
However, though, the police will usually suspect anyone that mysteriously died just as they had all these problems chasing after them. If it's too convenient, it's too convenient.
If it sounds too good to be true, it probably is.
Get more original, people.
Of course, though, the best fake deaths are the ones that have never been discovered.
Mm-hmm.
But we still got a pretty sweet list, and it's time to get started on it. So our first story today is from Miss Belle Gunness. It's a bit of a double whammy because not only does it involve somebody faking their death, called pseudocide, by the way.
A which cool new word that we
really
learned.
Cool, it's pseudocide.
Oh, really?
Not to be confused with suicide.
Pseudocide. Yeah. So she's a serial killer. And so we've got a fake death and one of the most prolific serial killer cases in American history.
Oh, wow.
We are talking about the Indiana ogress.
Belle Gunness.
Belle Gunness was born on November 11th, 1859, in Norway, in a town called Selbu, which is in the complete middle of absolutely nowhere. If you can picture Norway, it's in the middle of the bulb on the end, essentially. Like, it's...
the little bulbous part.
The bulb. And there's literally nothing...
hand motions that you're making right now. Charade this out is
honestly
just hilarious.
They remind me of a bulbous thing. It's just like he's like flopping around a little bit. Bulbous.
All right.
I'm going to name my kid Bulbous.
No, please
no, you're
going
to name it British Royal Navy, remember?
Yeah, that's true. I'm going to stop at one.
The Bulbous British Royal Navy.
Bulbous will be the meathead of the family. Walking in, Bulbous hungry. Here's your steak, Bulbous. And then he goes down to the basement because he's chained up. Because he scares me.
Don't chain up your children.
Well, if you're going to hurt me, I will.
Maybe you shouldn't have children.
No. Anyway, continue.
So the town that Belle is from, there's nothing there except for lakes. It's just water around them. There's nothing to do. She got tired of her life as a poor farmer in Norway and decided to move to the United States in 1881, hoping for a better life. And she eventually settled in Chicago, working as a domestic maid. While in Chicago, Belle Gunness met a man named Mads Albert Sorensen.
Yes, his name is Mads.
Mads Albert.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Did he happen to like own a company called Mad Albert's something?
No.
That's kind of disappointing.
He was also a Norwegian immigrant who was working in a department store. The two of them got married in 1884 and had four children together, Caroline, Axel, Myrtle, and Lucy, and then fostered a child named Jenny Olsen. Life was going well for the family, and in 1894, the couple decided to purchase a candy store together.
Matt's Candy Store. Yeah. I knew it.
I think that is an interesting business decision.
To say the least.
I've never really heard anybody go, oh, you know how I'm going to
That's not really,
really
a
rake
quick
in the
cash
bucks?
Grab.
I feel like that's always for lonely old men to do.
Mads was not lonely.
Oh, that's sad.
Well, that's what I'm
I feel like I see a lot of grandmas
store.
Running candy stores. I feel like I don't see
just
many guys running
generally
candy
generally sad old people.
Yeah.
That's a very lonely old person profession.
Yeah. It is.
Yeah.
However cute the idea was, it simply just wasn't making money for them.
Dawn. Shocking.
But in about a year and a half after opening, the store ended up burning down. This was devastating for Belle and her family, but the store was insured, and they were able to collect the money from
it. Thank God.
Tragedy wasn't over for the family, though.
No.
As within the next few years, the children Caroline and Axel both died of acute colitis.
Wait, their names were Caroline and Axel?
Axel, yeah.
Axel Ols, what was their name?
Axel Sorensen.
That's a pretty powerful name.
That is really cool. But
anyway, he died of acute colitis.
Which is not a cool name.
In 1900, their house also burned down. If there is one bright side to the situation, both of the kids and the house were also insured. So Belle, Mads, and their three kids had enough money to rebuild and move on.
If you're starting to get a little bit suspicious, you are correct.
Someone's a serial smoker.
On July 30th, 1900, Mads came home from work one day complaining of a headache. And being the caring wife that she was, Belle gave him medicine and went to cook him dinner. But when she came back to check on him, Mads was dead.
Bum, bum, bum.
The coroners claimed the cause of death was heart failure, but I'm going to let you in on a little bit of a secret here.
Mm-hmm.
Belle killed her husband, Mads. She killed her two children.
What?
She burned their house down.
Oh, no.
And she burned down their candy store.
I can see that.
And if you didn't see that coming, you're a moron. What kind of child has a life insurance policy? Are you for real?
All of them did.
Exactly.
This is the crazy part.
Which means that they were planned on being murdered.
Yeah. So why did Belle do all of this?
Money.
Good old insurance money.
Hell yeah.
What makes the world go round?
You see, July 30th was a special date because this was the exact day that Mads had two life insurance policies active as he was switching from a $2,000 policy to a $3,000 policy, and they were both still active on July 30th, 1900.
This was seems super shady, like, that you can actually do that.
Yeah.
But, like, it's just so weird to me that that's even like a loophole that you can find.
Mads' family knew what happened, essentially. They told the police, no, this is not some coincidence.
There's
we,
no
we
way.
We know she did this, but they didn't investigate.
Ridiculous.
So after poisoning her husband with strychnine, Belle was able to cash in $5,000 in life insurance policies, over $150,000 today.
Oof.
That's a lot of money.
Mm-hmm. In the case of her two children, she also poisoned them and collected insurance off of both of the infants. You already know she collected mad amounts of money from the house and the store burning down.
Oof.
Now that Belle had a fortune built off of murder and arson, she bought herself a nice farm in LaPorte, Indiana.
Aw, yay.
Yeah, a small
Cute.
Town about 70 miles from her old home in Chicago. While she was rich for now, Belle was, she was a bit of a thinker. She knew that the money wasn't going to last forever, and she needed to start finding some new victims.
Wow.
Her first fresh target was Peter Gunnis, another Norwegian man. And they got married on April 1st, 1902. Maybe this was an April Fool's prank that good old Peter was pulling, but he and his two children didn't live long enough to
or
back
maybe
out
it was
of it.
An April Fool's prank that Belle was pulling.
That's true. Maybe
April
it was.
Fools, you're going to see tomorrow. Ha ha.
Forever and ever until the end of time. April Fools.
Oof. Till death do us part.
Wow.
Man, they really built in like a scapegoat when you get married.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Pretty much. Like if you get tired of your wife, just kill her.
Yeah. That's like a contract that you can trigger at any time. Till death do us apart.
But I'm not dead yet.
Just about time, I think.
Bop.
The first one of them to go was Peter's youngest daughter, but Peter was suspicious and sent his other daughter away to save her.
Ooh. Serious case of favoritism here with Peter.
And she would be the only one to escape from Belle, the only person to survive her.
Wow.
In December of 1902, Belle killed Peter by smashing his skull in with a meat tenderizer.
Makes sense.
Ugh. Though she told police that a sausage grinder had fell and hit him in the head.
On
an
accident.
In
I think
kitchen.
That's the funniest thing ever.
At mock speed, I'm sure.
That's something
it
right out of Looney Tunes. A
like a piano falling on someone's head, except it's
like,
just a big sausage
it's
grinder.
Like when there's a shelf on top of people, and like one of the legs breaks, and it just goes. boom, 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 and then they have like kind of weird boner looking thing on their head.
Bell's lie wasn't as convincing this time around, though, and medical examiners decided that Peter's death was a murder. But in court, Bell was able to lie well enough to relieve her of guilt, and she collected another life insurance policy worth $32,000 today.
Wow.
So all of this husband business was beginning to get to be too much of a hassle for Bell, so she turned to an easier method that you may remember from season 1, episode 5, and we're talking about serious Nanny Doss vibes here.
Nanny Doss.
Yeah, remember the husband murderer? Yeah, that's her.
The Lonely Hearts murderer? Nanny Doss.
Oh, yeah. Bell Gunness started posting columns in a local Norwegian newspaper saying that she was a wealthy widow looking for a husband to spend the rest of her days with.
Ooh.
She would talk to these men for a little bit, then convince them to come to her farm with all of their money and to keep it a secret from anyone. Then she would poison them, kill them with an axe or shovel, then either burn the bodies, bury them in burlap sacks, or feed them to the pigs. Do you remember that scene in Wizard of Oz where, like, Dorothy falls in the pig pen?
Oh, yeah.
There's a reason why all of her uncles freaked out, because pigs will eat anything. If you want to dispose of a body, just give it to a pig.
That
it's disgusting.
That was an episode of Criminal
Minds. Yeah.
Yeah, it's pretty gross.
You gotta understand, though, for these Norwegian guys, this was a great opportunity for them to swoop in on a nice Norwegian woman who was a widow. She was incredibly wealthy.
And in America.
Mm-hmm. Had a big farm of her own and was just looking for somebody to spend her life with, apparently.
Nowadays, though, if someone saw an ad like that, you immediately think, serial killer?
Yeah.
Which, for Nigerian reasons like this.
Prince. But back then...
Nigerian prince.
No, this is Norwegian serial killer.
Norwegian... prick.
This went on for years, and estimates for her murder count are around 40, though some claim the number could be more than 100. That seems a little bit steep, but you never know.
The issue is that it was hard to tell because people kept it a secret.
Yeah.
Because Bell told the guys, hey, don't tell any of your family, don't tell anybody.
Yeah, and they just take off
and
disappear.
And we'll surprise them with our love.
Yeah.
Yeah, right.
Yeah,
also,
okay.
You can only account for... maybe she just preemptively killed them, or like maybe something happened where like they didn't bring all their money.
Yeah.
It's really hard to take a body count.
Mm-hmm.
You never know. No one really knows how much money Bell made from this either, but it seems like most of the men brought between $2,000 and $3,000 each.
Wow.
So she was doing pretty well. The last of Bell's victims was Andrew Helgelian, who Bell had been talking to for about a year and a half before she convinced him to come live with her.
Complete disclosure, by the way, all these names are Norwegian and Scandinavian names, so we are going to butcher them entirely, kind of like Bell did to any man she laid eyes on.
Not even man, any living creature.
That's true.
I bet she killed plants too, I bet.
She's like, a guaranteed very bad gardener.
For
she
sure.
She let all of her tomatoes die. My mom killed a lot of tomatoes.
Awesome. So Andrew shows up to Bell's farm with all of his money, and Bell killed him. But his brother was suspicious that he hadn't heard from Andrew at all. On April 26th, Bell Gunness did two extremely fishy things back to back. First, she wrote a will and got it signed, and then she went to the bank and took out all of her money in cash.
In cash.
Now, I'm no genius, but you don't do that unless you're like planning something. Like you're about to go on a murder spree. Or
you're getting out of town.
You're crazy and you
fucking off to Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
You're putting it all in a bunker.
Listen, sometimes you just got to bury all your money in the backyard. Uh-huh. All right. It's not that out of here.
Banks are not trustworthy.
Mm-mm.
That's what my great grandfather did. He buried all his money in mayonnaise jars in the backyard and left my grandfather a map to where he could find them. And my grandfather went and dug them up. And that's what we bought our lake house with, the money.
Was it like
mayonnaise?
We never
jars?
Found all the mayonnaise jars. They are still there.
Trip to Maine for mayonnaise?
Well, somebody else owns the house now, but...
So we show up with shovels and kill them with shovels, feed them to the pigs.
We pull a Bell Gunness, we hit them a little bit in the dome, we bury them where the jars are, and we walk out with money, and the bodies are just there.
We don't even have to dig separate holes for their bodies.
Yeah.
Master plan.
Just pop them in like ostriches, just head in the sand, and then just leave their bodies hanging out, and I'm just like... Yeah, my neighbors are fucking weird.
Wow, he drowned in the yard.
He's looking in the dirt.
When you said ostrich, I thought you were going to make a Letterkenny reference.
No.
But
yeah, if you guys haven't watched Letterkenny yet, after we've plugged them a million times, please
go
do
it. Oh my God.
Season 7's a little bit of a letdown, but season 8 is bomb as fuck. Anyway, 2 days later on April 28th, 1908... Bell's farm burned to the ground.
Whoa.
Authorities were able to identify her children, including Jenny Olsen, and a headless body that kind of matched what Bell looked like. Andrew's brother pressed the police to look on the property for his brother. Mm-hmm. And although the police were really just hoping to find Belle's head so they could identify her, they ended up stumbling across the site of one of the most gruesome scenes in American history.
Ooh.
When police were digging in the pig pens on the farm,
oh.
they dug up multiple bodies, skulls, and bone fragments, many of them in burlap sacks.
The burlap sacks, by the way, were absolutely disgusting.
I can imagine.
And apparently she had a certain way of killing, too. She would hack off their arms, like, at the elbow and their legs at the knees. And, like,
what
that
a weirdo.
Was what she did.
Why?
I don't
different
know.
Different strokes for different folks, I guess.
I feel like that's just impractical. Why not just lop off the whole limb, you know?
Because she's a serial killer. They do weird
she's
shit
she's obviously
like that.
Not right in the head.
Yeah, but you'd think if you're a serial killer, you'd be more meticulous about it.
Well...
Maybe it was her
She
MO.
Was. That was her being meticulous. Is that what she... That's what she
that's
did.
That's what she liked.
That's what she did with all the bodies.
Fair enough.
Okay.
Creepy. So although the police were able to piece together many bodies, they never actually found Belle's head. And that's because she faked her death.
Ooh. 100% she did it.
For sure. I mean, there's no proof, but we'll get into that.
She did it.
Belle probably knew that her scheme couldn't last forever, so she devised an escape plan for herself. One night, she went out and found a lady who looked roughly like her, killed her, and brought her back to the farm and decapitated her. Now, this is the part that I thought was kind of a little bit odd, but then I realized, like, I was like, how did she find a body that looked like her? But then I was like, this lady's a murderer. She has no qualms about killing whoever.
Yeah. Yeah.
She could have just found this random woman on the side of the road and chopped her head off.
She's wearing green. I like green. You're next.
A little interesting thing, though. Belle Gunness actually was about 6 feet tall.
Oh, my God.
And weighed around 200
pounds. Amazon.
She was huge.
Amazon.
Yeah. So I guess actually finding a body that kind of fit hers was probably a little trickier
yeah, that's
than we're
true.
Giving her credit for.
What if it was a man? No, they definitely would have known that.
Yeah.
Obviously. Well. After that, Belle killed the rest of her children, set the house on fire, and made her escape.
Easy.
The fire and murders were originally placed on Ray Lamphere, a helper on the farm, but it was pretty clear that he was not responsible for the murders, although he was charged for arson and given 20 years in prison. Kind of unfair, but anyway.
Wow.
The mystery of Belle Gunness is technically still unsolved today, though most of the evidence points to her faking her death, including the perfectly timed will, the emptying of her bank accounts, and she was reportedly spotted multiple times in Chicago after the fire.
She did it. She faked her death, and that's that.
I believe that Belle faked her death and lived out the rest of her life comfortably with the money she took, and a lot of people agree with that.
There's no way she didn't. She was already a mass murderer, bona fide serial killer, emptied her bank account, conveniently wrote a will 2 days before her house burned down, already had 2 arson charges on her.
Yeah.
She knows
everything
what she's
she
doing.
Does was just convenient.
What yeah. if she was planning to fake her death, and then she actually accidentally, like, slipped down the fucking barn? And she just, like, died under
and knocked her head off?
And she's like, fucking hit, like, the
like
piece
a fucking
of...
Lego dude, you can just take his head off.
She got buried under the hay, so they just couldn't find her.
Oh, okay.
For our second story, we're going to jump from America to 20th century Spain and dive into a spy thriller.
This is so cool.
This one is really fun.
I love conquistadors.
No, not quite.
Our man is Juan Garcia, who was born on February 14th, 1902, the day of love, February 14th, a little Valentine's Day.
Hey now.
Which is right around the corner, yeah. Gentlemen, don't forget.
And he was born in Barcelona, Spain. Juan never did all that well in school. He got in fights a lot with teachers, and he ended up dropping out of school to start working in a hardware store.
Huh.
Juan jumped around between a bunch of different jobs, but ended up studying at the Royal Poultry School.
I want to know what the fuck this is.
It's you go to school and learn how to farm chickens.
But why is there a school for that? Why is it royal?
There's tons of agriculture schools, and it... Okay, so you know how we have, like, state schools and stuff?
Yeah.
So in Europe, a lot of those schools are called royal schools because they're, like, government-funded and they're
Makes
full of themselves.
Sense. Uh-huh.
So they call
Private
it royal.
Public, like, shit like that kind of thing, or...
Well, yeah, like, in New York, we have SUNY schools, which is State University of New York. And so, in a lot of European countries, they're just called royal academies because...
Directly under the queen.
Queen Elizabeth comes in and lectures on Tuesdays and Thursdays.
Oh, God.
Kill your husband swiftly. That is
her
all.
Husband is not dead. He's on
kicking.
Death's doorstep.
Oh,
but
my
like,
God. The man looks like a vampire.
Yeah. Have you seen Prince Philip lately?
No.
Obviously not in person,
well,
but like I've pictures
never,
of him.
Yeah, no.
He looks awful.
His body looks
no
crinkled.
Disrespect, but he really looks bad.
You ever think she killed him when he was young and like embalmed him?
That's... He literally looks like he's dead in every picture I've ever seen.
He's just a mummy roaming around Great Britain.
Sir Philip is sleeping. M'lady, he's bleeding. No, he's not.
I love your Queen Elizabeth impression.
His kidney is just hanging out. They're like, honey, tuck that back in.
Philip, please. How indecent.
Anyway, that was a completely unintended rant.
Do you think she's ever called anyone a wanker?
Oh, for sure.
Okay.
So I would pay Queen Elizabeth to call me a wanker.
She's probably called, like, heads of states wankers.
Probably, like, yeah. Or Meghan Markle, because they have beef for no fucking reason. Meghan's a princess, literally.
So Juan, he studied at the Royal Poultry School in the 1930s, and he ended up running his own poultry farm. Yeah, my man.
Thank God he went to school. He got his degree.
So Juan was successfully running his own poultry farm when the Spanish Civil War broke out in 1936.
What a twist.
Juan Garcia didn't really have any stake in the war, but he certainly did not like the rise of...
Of course he didn't have any stake in the war. He had chickens.
Oh my God.
That's pretty good.
But he was not a big fan of fascism, and so he mostly stayed out of the war. But when the conflict was brewing in the rest of Europe, World War II, he decided it was time for him to do something.
Juan
originally wanted to be a spy for the Allies, so he got in contact with agencies in the U.S. and in Britain, but they all turned him away. This wasn't going to stop Juan, though. He was determined to make his plan work, so he got in contact with the Nazis. The Nazis were more than happy to take a spy from Spain, one of their closest allies, and they sent him to Britain to start spying and to build a network of informants that could help them win the war. Juan didn't go to Britain, though. He settled in Lisbon, Portugal, and started to build a network of fake spies, using information from newspapers and mostly just making things up. He created a whole network of fake people, just wrote their names down, and he would report under their name, like, every single day. He had this whole list of fake people that were his spies.
Yeah. At first, I was like, no, Juan, not the Nazis. And then I was like, oh, wait,
good
yeah,
guy,
go Juan. You're a badass.
Can you imagine the government learning, like, just that they turned down a really smart guy to spy on the Nazis?
The Nazis were none the wiser, though, and they soon were providing a large amount of funds to Juan while he lied about everything. They were sending him a lot of money to run his whole spy organization, which didn't exist at all.
That's a lot of takeout money.
During all of this, Juan kept contacting Allied spy networks, and eventually he got a job with the British MI6, a department of British intelligence that handled foreign agents. They were quite impressed with Juan's work deceiving the Nazis so far, so MI6 moved him to Britain and helped to expand his fake network as he fed Nazis information that wasted tons of time and resources. Well, in Britain, Juan became a member of MI5, the department that handles domestic agents, and he worked closely with Tomás Harris, another double agent from Spain.
That's awesome.
He's really cool. Juan's greatest achievement came during Operation Fortitude, which was the intelligence mission to move Nazi resources away from Normandy, where they were planning to invade. Juan fed the Germans tons of false information about the location of the attack, the timing of it, and the number of troops, which they took as fact and planned accordingly. They believed Juan's word.
They really trusted this
man. For literally no reason. Like, if they had done any checking up on him at all, they would have seen what he was doing.
He reported to them daily.
Yeah, but, like, how far did they look into it, or did they just blindly trust this guy?
Think about it this way. If they don't have another sources to compare it to, they're not going to think anything of it.
He was like...
I just think it's so funny that, like, they could have avoided that situation so easily.
Well, to the Germans, Juan was, like, their top guy in Britain.
Yeah.
He was the man. He was running this whole spy network and getting all the dirt on them, and they believed it.
Also, while we were talking about all this, I just thought of a really funny, like, tagline. Could be, it's like... He's at his chicken farm doing whatever, and someone walks up to him, and they're like, what's your name? And he goes, Juan. James Juan.
Oh, my God.
Oh, my God.
Good Lord.
Juan's greatest achievement came after the invasion of Normandy, though. While Allied troops had already invaded France, Juan was able to keep 2 German tank divisions and 19 infantry divisions in northern France, telling them that Normandy was only a diversion and that the real attack was coming soon. This deception bought the Allies valuable time and is partly responsible for the eventual Allied victory. For his role in Operation Fortitude, Juan Garcia was knighted by the British, and he was actually awarded an Iron Cross by the Germans as well, because they never found out about his deception.
Is that not the most badass thing you've ever heard?
That's hilarious.
Yeah.
So funny. So with the war coming to an end, Juan and the British intelligence became worried that his life could be at risk from vengeful Nazis, so it was time to disappear. Juan had to divorce his current wife, Araceli Carballo, and traveled to Angola in 1948, where he reportedly died of malaria. The story was spread around and made it back to Spain, where he was officially pronounced dead. In reality, though, Juan moved to Venezuela, one, because no one there would ever recognize him, and second, because much of Latin America was sympathetic to the Nazis during World War II, and the Allies wanted to keep an eye open in the region. Juan Garcia went about his life for the next few decades peacefully. He married a woman named Carmen Alvarez and had two children, though he certainly missed his old life and family in Europe, which I think is so sad because, like...
That's really sad.
He had to divorce his wife leave his family.
He had to leave all of his friends at MI5. Everything that he had built in his life was gone now.
Just so he could spy on the...
Well, to save his life, Nazis. Too.
Yeah, just because the war was over, that did not mean that Nazi sympathizers were done. And if they ever found out about how much he fucked them over, he could have been killed very easily.
Yeah. So everything was kept nice and quiet until a reporter named Rupert Allison started digging into Juan Garcia in 1971.
God, idiot.
He didn't make much progress at first, as everyone genuinely believed that he had died, and anyone who knew the truth was in MI5, and they certainly weren't giving up any secrets. However, in 1984, an old informant in Spain gave up Juan's name to Rupert, who then called everyone with the name Juan Garcia in Catalonia, which, as you can imagine, is a ton of people.
That is so many people. That's like calling everybody named, like, Pat Smith.
Yeah.
In the entire East Coast.
Yeah.
John Doe.
Can you imagine? And imagine all the random telephone calls to, hello, is this Juan Garcia? Yes, it is. Are you, by any chance, an undercover spy who worked with the MI5 in World War II and also for the Nazis? What?
No, I wish.
Can you imagine?
You fucking
Those phone calls must have been so weird.
I can't even imagine. Like, if someone calls me today and is like, are you Robert? And I'm like, nope, click.
I can barely call to, like, order pizza. I couldn't call some random person and ask if they were a British spy.
Yeah, like an actual spy. I'd probably...
Had, like, a code. Oh, I'm sorry to interrupt you.
No, it's okay.
I was going to say, do you think he has, like, a code where, like, you'd call me and be like, hey, Juan Garcia, yeah? The chicken is in the hen house. And he expected some fucking...
Are your shoes untied? What?
He expected some, like, no, they're in the chicken coop. It's like, ah, there it is.
Uh-huh. So Rupert eventually got in contact with Juan's nephew, who was able to connect the two, and they met in New Orleans on May 20th, 1984. Rupert was able to convince Juan to come back to Britain, where he met with Prince Philip, shout out to the man, in Buckingham Palace.
The mummy man himself.
Sorry we reamed you at the beginning of this episode. Reunited with his friends in British intelligence and visited the beaches of Normandy, where he helped the Allies start to liberate Europe.
Aww.
Juan went back to Venezuela and lived the rest of his life in Caracas, where he died on October 10th, 1988.
Aww.
Juan Garcia's legacy is incredible. He was one of the most important agents to have ever been in MI5. He's probably the only person to be given awards by both sides in World War II, and he genuinely worked his hardest to make a positive difference in the world of fascism, genocide, and war.
10 out of 10 guy. You really? Gotta
He's
hand
just
it to
a
him.
Stand up fucking guy.
Can you imagine going to fucking chicken school and you end up helping to fight
being
a world
double
war?
Agent? Literally. Like, what?
But he didn't have any political connections or anything. He was literally, we joke about it, but he was a chicken farmer who decided, I need to do something better with my life. And he went and did all of this.
Does that mean that I should become a spy? Just drop what I'm doing and be like, I'm not doing anything productive
in my life. There's one critical
life.
Thing you're missing. You're not a chicken farmer.
I That's had true. Chickens, though.
Did you go to the Royal Poultry School, though?
No, I didn't. No. I'll shut up now.
All right, so we're going to move from one of the most respectable people on Earth to...
No, you have to respect him. You have to respect this guy. It's a totally different kind of respect, though.
Yep, he's respectable, but he is also a dipshit.
Absolutely.
So we're going to start with Timothy Dexter here. Timothy Dexter's story is one of the most insane, off-the-walls, and ridiculous things I have ever heard. But it's also probably my favorite story of all time.
That's awesome.
It's
me too.
I'm so excited. Fucking funny.
You should be. This is great stuff.
So Timothy Dexter, he was born on January 22nd, 1747 in the town of Malden, Massachusetts.
Wow, he old.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Which is about 7 miles from Boston. Now, Boston back in the mid-1700s, it isn't like what it is today. The city back then only had a population of about 16,000 people. And it was a lot smaller without all the high-rises and stuff that are there now. But it was still a big bustling port city with tons of influence over the American colonies. The American
colonies... Yes, we're talking colonies here.
Oh, yeah,
this
we're going way back. The American colonies around this time were also starting to reach a tipping point, with the French and Indian War being just a few years off, and then the American Revolution starting in the 1760s, which resulted in America becoming a country of its own.
In case you were asleep in history class, we'll run it back for you.
This was the environment that young Tim Dexter was growing up in, with new ideas, movements, and heroes all around him in the streets of Boston.
Wow.
Timothy started off life working with his family on the farm and never really attended school, but that didn't matter to young Tim. He was loving life anyway.
Mm-hmm.
By age 16, Mr. Dexter found himself an apprenticeship in Boston doing leather working, and he was pretty damn good at it, too.
Damn, he's working with leather.
And this apprenticeship was Dexter's first run-in with good luck, which was going to become a reoccurring theme in his life.
Good luck?
Yes.
Yes.
Like, just genuine, like, juju, like, karma, that type shit?
Yes.
Lady Luck was smiling at this guy, I'll tell you that.
They were having an affair.
Yeah, probably.
Now, leather working wasn't considered to really be a high-end job at the time. That was still, like, a kind of a peasant job. But it was making Timothy enough money to get by, and the masters that he was working with actually managed to create a monopoly on Moroccan leather.
Yo.
Which was
fancy
a,
stuff.
Monopoly, fuck, shit, never mind. Nope. I was going to say Moroccan monopoly.
So the Moroccan leather was used in a lot of fancy outfits like high-end gloves, bags, coats, and this stuff was top tier. They were the only ones in town selling it.
Gucci before Gucci.
Mm-hmm.
Correct.
At age 21, Dexter moved on to his next task and started his own business doing leather working, and he sold leather fashion products like gloves and coats, but this is when people started getting frisky in Boston, and shit was going down between the colonists and the British, and a whole bunch of tea got dumped in the Boston Harbor, which is a war crime.
I think we're going to have to talk about the Boston Tea Party in every episode of this season.
I also think it's interesting, like, what better profession to be in a time where Boston's getting frisky than working with leather?
Yeah.
Yeah, pretty much.
So Boston was not in great shape anymore, but this was not going to stop a man like Timothy Dexter.
Absolutely not.
Timothy moved to a different part of Boston, and he ended up meeting a rich widow named Elizabeth Frothingham.
Excuse me?
Super unfortunate name.
Frothingham.
And the two of them got married. And yes, Timothy is a mahoosive gold digger.
Sounds like a pig with rabies.
Yeah, it's Frothingham.
Yeah.
Now, Timmy, he had made it to the upper class. He married rich, baby.
Mm-hmm.
But his
and he had a good chunk of money on his own.
Yeah, he was
from all his
bad.
Leather working.
Leather.
He wasn't, like, filthy rich by any means, but he was doing all right.
But all of his new neighbors, including many founding fathers, too, they
literally.
Were, yeah, they were not fond of him. As he was uneducated, uncultured, and overall, the guy was a bit of a moron.
Kind of a dingus.
Mm-hmm.
Well,
he was just very, like... He had never really gone to school. He just wasn't really very educated.
He just didn't know how to act, either. He didn't know how to act around people.
Well, homie didn't expect to grow up rich. He was just like, oh,
exactly.
Shit.
Exactly.
Yeah. She got money?
Yeah.
That's awesome.
What Tim wanted more than anything was just to be liked by the high-ups in society.
Aw,
so
Timmy.
He did everything he could to make them like him. He continued to run his leather business out of his basement. And when he decided he was done with that, Timothy moved on to public office. However, all of the officials in town knew who he was, and they were not going to give him a job working with them.
Doing
it was
anything
not
fucking
happen.
Important.
So they ignored all of his requests.
His emails.
And I mean dozens and dozens of letters. Until one day, they just gave up. They gave in and came up with a very prestigious
they
title.
They created a
him.
Special title
yes,
just
did.
For him.
I can imagine some guy just sitting at his desk with his fucking quill and inkwell, just like writing away, and there's thunk. Thunk on the window, and he looks down and he just sees fucking
a rock
Tim,
like thrown
no,
through the window.
Tim throwing carrier pigeons, but like just,
they're not flying, they're just like plunking into the windows.
He has like a barrel and they keep running to his hands, and he's just like,
thump, thump.
Give me a job. And he's like, damn it.
And so they came up with this job for Tim, very important office called the Informer of Deer,
an esteemed title.
What, does he talk to deer?
Well, hold on.
His new job was to keep track of the deer population in town and make sure that it was well kept. But, like, this, back in the day, that was an important thing.
I mean, yeah, this is funny.
You know, if you had deer population that was going out of control, then that could really fuck
that's
up
the
town.
That's still important today. Like,
you
you get more tags for hunting, like, to
like
control the population and stuff like that.
Should have been a job beforehand.
Yeah, so his job was genuinely important.
But there's a little bit of an issue.
There's one detail I should add here.
He doesn't know what deer are.
No.
There hadn't been any deer in Malden for 20 years.
Literally 20 years, there had not been a single deer in the town.
That's
okay. And they knew that.
Okay, now that makes sense.
So there were no deer to inform on, but Timothy Dexter loved his job nonetheless.
And good for him. All of this was happening to Timothy while the American Revolution was raging around him, and the new Continental Congress released a new currency called the Continental Dollar and tried to make everyone use it. But most people didn't think that the Americans had any chance in hell of winning. Neither did the Americans, really.
Yeah.
So they refused to use this dollar, and it became insanely devalued. Even after the Americans did end up winning the war, the Continental Dollar was super inflated and totally useless. But this is what all the American soldiers were paid in for their service, so you can imagine they were pretty pissed. To make up for it, some rich benefactors decided to buy it off of the soldiers and give them real money in exchange. Oh. And Timothy saw this as his opportunity. Remember, his one goal in life was to be liked by the upper-class citizens, so he thought that if he did this kind deed of helping out American soldiers, everyone would love him. So Timothy did the very sensible thing and spent all of his savings on worthless currency and literally bought shiploads of the money from the soldiers.
That is what every investor will tell you to do. If you see a risky investment that isn't really going to pay off at all, you better put everything
totally
you own into
your entire life
savings.
You better
go all in. Yeah.
So this was the end of Timothy Dexter, as he spent his entire fortune on this worthless money and now he had nothing except no.
Exactly.
You see, when the Constitution was ratified, Alexander Hamilton, yes, him, put a
clause
in there
Hamilton.
Saying that the U.S. government would buy back the Continental Dollar at 1% of their value. Timothy Dexter bought the Continental Dollars at fractions of a penny. So when he sold them for a penny apiece, he multiplied his wealth like crazy and became insanely rich.
Bro, he fucking flipped the script on the government.
Yes.
Just wait. Somehow, after making probably the dumbest investment possible, Tim was back on top and richer than ever. With all of his new wealth, Timothy bought the most luxurious estate in Newburyport, Mass. And this place was a legit bachelor pad, minus the fact that he lived there with his wife and two kids.
You know.
The house... Yeah, it happens. The house was seriously tricked out, though, and he had the most expensive furniture money could buy. He commissioned tons of paintings and sculptures and even had curtains that once belonged to the Queen of France.
My man was
frolicking in the backyard.
Yeah.
No deer in Malden, you say?
Hey, well, let's go to Newburyport. Once he set up shop, it was time to get back to business, though.
Ooh.
Timothy bought a fleet of merchant ships and was ready to make some trades, and his neighbors were more than happy to give him some advice, but it was all terrible advice that they hoped would drive him out of business and out of town.
They wanted Timothy out of here.
They wanted nothing to do with him. Timmy Dexter's first big trade was going to be in the warming pan market, which are big pans on a stick that you put coals in to keep your bed warm at night. You know, like in Pirates of the Caribbean, the first one, how she's got that like pan of coals that her little maid puts under the bed, and then she ends up dropping it on one of the pirates, and it like burns his face.
To be honest,
those things. Well, you don't remember that?
It was just something you popped under your bed to keep you warm at night.
Yeah,
it was a good idea.
I just didn't remember the reference.
I can't believe it didn't catch more beds on fire, though. It probably did. These were really handy for those cold New England nights. So Timothy, with the advice of his neighbors, decided to ship 42,000 of them to Jamaica, where they were actively trying to invent air conditioning because it was so fucking hot. Obviously, this was a terrible decision that would spell the end of his career,
but
and it certainly would have if Timothy hadn't sold every last fucking one of them.
He sold 42,000 bed warming pans.
When the shipment of warming pans arrived in Jamaica, the people there had no clue what they were, but soon people started using them as giant ladles for molasses, which was the main export of Jamaica. So this was perfect for them, and Timothy walked away selling each one at an 80% profit.
Dude, this man fucking, he should play poker.
He tore the game up at every turn. Every turn.
This sounds like a
you literally can't, like, track him. He just does things that you're like, wow, that's the end. And he never, ever fucks up. No. Not once.
Well, he does. He just gets lucky about it.
Yeah, well,
or
that's
he's
true.
He's extremely calculated.
Mm. Once Timothy got back in New England, people could not believe that he had sold all the warming pans. And they decided, all right, enough is enough. This guy has got to go.
We're just going to kill him.
And they set him up with... to fail once and for all. They
there
gave him
no
the
way
ultimate
he was gonna be
terrible
able to do
plan.
This
time, they told Timothy to go sell coal to Newcastle, a city in Northern Ireland that was famous for its massive coal mine. They already had all the coal they could ever want. It was so famous for its coal that there was actually a saying, go carry coal to Newcastle, which was essentially somebody telling somebody to go do something worthless and fuck themselves, essentially. Like, hey, go fucking carry coal to Newcastle.
All right.
Peasant.
This is the exact advice that Timothy Dexter took as the word of God.
I love it so much.
And carry coal to Newcastle he did. So Timothy loads up his ships with a fuck ton of coal and makes his way across the Atlantic to Newcastle. And when he arrives, the merchants there literally laughed in his face and sent him away because they had all the coal they could ever want. So Timothy had to set sail back across the Atlantic to America with all this useless coal and lost a fortune on the voyage. Sadly, while sailing the ocean, Timothy Dexter's fleet was caught in a storm and they died, bringing the antics of Timothy Dexter to an end.
I don't believe that.
No, and you're entirely right to not believe that.
I knew it.
When Timothy Dexter landed in Newcastle with his shipment of worthless coal, the miners in Newcastle were on strike, and the merchants in Newcastle were in desperate need of coal to sell. So Timothy rolled into town and sold every ounce of coal to Newcastle, proving the haters wrong yet again and earning another fortune.
I love this guy.
He is the fucking king's fool. I love it. I love it.
Timothy continued these ridiculous investments for years, including selling tens of thousands of Bibles to the East Indies, where priests all of a sudden decided that all the native people had to be converted.
Mm-hmm. There's no use for the Bibles until that happened, and he sent them anyway.
He sold shiploads of cats to islands in the Caribbean who were having rodent infestations.
Coincidentally.
And he bought.
Where did he get the cats from?
I don't know.
I have no idea.
I don't know. And he bought hundreds of tons of whale bones right when they were going into style to be used in corsets all around the world.
He literally had like the biggest, like, he had a monopoly on whale bones pretty much. Yeah, he had more than anybody else.
You know what I think? I think he had the first version of the Magic 8-Ball.
He must have.
Like, oh, Magic 8-Ball.
Or like a genie or something.
What do I do with all these fucking cats? Shake, shake, shake. Sell. Okay.
See, but here's the thing, though. As stupid as this sounds, here's essentially what he was doing. He would buy up everything that he could find of one very specific product.
Yeah.
And so with the whale bones, he bought every whale bone he could find. And then if anybody wanted them for anything, they had to go to him.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so it sounds stupid, and it was a lot of dumb luck that, like, oh, whale bone corsets became the new thing. But still,
anybody who wanted a whale bone for any reason had to go to him.
It was still kind of smart. But, like, the sending coal to Newcastle thing, like, that was completely ridiculous. And the warming pans to Jamaica, come on. So some of these kind of actually genuinely smart, but I don't think he did it from a place of financial genius.
And the thing about the warming pans to Jamaica that gets me is, like, he went on a lot of these trips. Like, Timothy actually went.
Yeah.
And so it wasn't like he sent these warming pans to Jamaica thinking, oh, they're going to need these. He went, and when they were like, what are those? We don't need that. He was like, oh, but wait, you could use them as ladles. So he convinced them that they needed them.
He was a decent
salesman.
So
it wasn't like he was completely stupid.
Well, yeah.
He just made horrible investments.
Panned out.
But he was a great salesman.
Somehow he fucking did it. However insane and lucrative all these trades were, Timothy Dexter, he still wasn't happy because all of his neighbors and classy townspeople hated him. To see where his true friends were and to see who actually even liked him, Timothy devised an insane plan that tops everything else he had done so far. He planned to fake his death.
Timothy let a few people in on the plan, including his wife, kids, and some close friends, and they went about organizing the event.
Aww.
He had notes written up inviting all of the wealthy elites to his funeral, got a master craftsman to build him an elaborate coffin, and turned his basement into a tomb.
Like full-on classy
mummy,
like mummy vibes, yeah.
Damn,
with Prince Philip.
I hope his casket was made out of entirely whalebone.
That would be hilarious. A few days before the funeral, notes were sent out saying that Timothy Dexter had died, and on that day, over 3,000 people showed up for the funeral, which was a lavish affair with fine wines and celebrations. Timothy watched the whole thing from his coffin, and he was happy with how it was going until he noticed that his wife wasn't crying or mourning at all. She was actually smiling, you know, because her husband's not dead and this whole shamil is fucking funny.
Yeah.
Outraged by this, Timothy Dexter rose from the dead and proceeded to berate his wife and beat her with his cane in front of 3,000 guests who thought he was dead.
He fucking rose up from the tomb, cane in hand, and started beating a bitch with it.
Right? After this spectacle, Timothy just went about his business and enjoyed the party like nothing ever happened.
Poured himself a glass of wine.
Dude, poor
just went around mingling. Hey, how are you enjoying my funeral? Nice. Timothy certainly never faked his death to try and escape his life. But it was such a petty move that you just have to appreciate it.
It's beautiful. It's beautiful.
But you ain't gotta beat your wife.
Okay. No, okay. You don't have
domestic
to beat your
violence,
wife.
Not great, but the rest of it, come on.
I just feel bad.
It's ridiculously funny.
I feel bad for the wife because, like, she knew the whole plan, and she was like, damn, this is going exactly what how my dearest husband went. Oh, he's going to be so happy that everyone
that's exactly what I'm saying.
Yeah. Like, and he's like, why are you not crying?
Bitch, why aren't you crying? Because you're not dead. No excuses!
Don.
I just picture him rising out of the coffin like fucking zombie. Like Dracula.
Like Dracula.
And he's like, you whore! And he's like, boomerang the cane at her ass.
You!
She's like, what?
Now, after the whole faking his death fiasco went down, Timothy, he had one last goal in his life, and that was to secure his legacy, like all the great philosophers of the time.
Except, what's the issue here? Timothy probably didn't even know what a philosopher was.
Yeah, he also wasn't a great one.
And he certainly can't spell it.
So, Timothy Dexter, a man who dropped out of school at 8 years old, who could barely read or write, who was labeled as uneducated and uncultured, he decided to write a book. And write a book he did.
Oh, God.
Called A Pickle for the Knowing Ones, or Plain Truths in a Homespun Dress.
And if you want to read a little bit of it, it's over on our socials. I highly suggest you do.
Is it good?
It's hilarious.
His book is 40 pages of incoherent ramblings, horribly misspelled. There's no punctuation. There's random capitalization. And it is just the perfect summary of Timothy Dexter.
Absolutely.
There's no other way to wrap up Timothy Dexter better than A Pickle for the Knowing Ones.
A Pickle for the Knowing
and
Ones.
And the title just gets me every time. Mm-hmm. Every time I hear it, I'm like, tee-hee. It's just so funny.
I want to know what it even means, though. What in his mind, what does that mean? A Pickle for the Knowing Ones. What?
Maybe
what's that
it's
mean?
Like... the knowing ones, like the people who get him and understand him.
Yeah, it's gotta be.
A pickle for you is a good thing. Like, he's giving them a pickle. Like, yes, thank you for supporting me.
Maybe.
Or like a clue. Like, kind of like in Morse code, like, a pickle for the knowing ones is like those.
Maybe it's
who
like
know
a secret code.
Me.
Maybe.
Yeah.
So, Timothy also had a fear and hatred of anybody that was college educated. He completely distrusted them. He hated them with his entire being. And that's why he did not give a fuck about his book, because it was his book.
Spelling,
and he
was
going to write it however he wanted.
I mean, go you, Tim.
So yet again, despite there being no reason for anybody to buy this book, he wasn't a philosopher. He wasn't anybody that famous, but his book fucking flew off the shelves and it was
reprinted
multiple times with the second printing.
This is my favorite part.
The second printing of his book, it contained a page of just periods, commas, and other punctuation with instructions for the readers to salt and pepper as they please.
Now, this is the best petty move I've ever heard, because the biggest flack he was getting for the book was that there was no punctuation. There was nothing in it. So he basically just gave the big old middle finger to everybody and was like, here's a whole entire fucking
here's
page
your
of
fucking
it.
Punctuation.
Do it yourselves.
That's hilarious.
If you're that fucking needy.
That's oh my fucking hilarious. God. I love that.
On October 26, 1806, Timothy Dexter, unfortunately, he did die for real.
For realsies.
For realsies. I'm not pranking you anymore. Like, he actually did die. And I think we should remember him every October 26th, Dexter Day.
Yeah.
Dexter Day.
Dexter Day.
All right.
Where we just do
it's
dumb
in the calendars.
Things.
While the legendary man himself died over 200 years ago, guess what? He fucking won. Because his book, A Pickle for the Knowing Ones, is selling on Amazon, and guess who already bought their copy of it?
You did not.
Yeah.
It's like $7.
Yeah. It's great. You can also find the whole thing online for free, too. There's a website called, like, timothydexter.com or something.
Yeah, it's like a website dedicated to him.
So if you want to go read A Pickle for the Knowing Ones in its entirety, completely unedited, unchanged, everything is still... I don't want to say spelled, because I don't feel like spelled even applies to Timothy's writing,
nope.
But everything is still spelled the way that he spelled it. There's no punctuation,
it's
random capitalizations.
It's written exactly how he did it.
We should do an audiobook of it.
Oh my God.
You're so right.
How many pages are
so right.
It's only 40 pages long.
You can't divide that evenly into three, but...
All right. No. So listeners, if you want to hear us sit down and read this book for you, let us know.
Well, Here's the thing. I don't know if I physically can. I think I'd stroke out after the first page.
I'm not going to promise that we are going to be able to read it coherently. I'm not going to say that it's going to make any sense.
Can we even do that at all?
Yeah, I'm sure.
Or is there, like, copyright things?
He's dead. Who fucking cares?
That's true.
All right.
Who's going to fight him? His beaten wife? She's probably dead, too.
wouldn't defend his honor, that's for sure.
I hope she's dead by now anyway. This was happening.
Or she might look like Prince Philip.
Yeah.
Oh, God.
Poor Prince Philip. We're really ragging on him.
We really did.
I was like, damn, it'd be funny if we just fucking sat like here in the dickheads and had like our own little pages of it.
So if you want to listen to us read that book in its entirety, let us know and we will sit down and do it.
Even if you don't, I still kind of want to do it. But like, it'd be appreciated if we had, you know.
Tell us on Facebook or on Instagram or leave a review on one of these episodes and let us know if you want to hear it. Because I would love to do that. Or
maybe we could put up
pigeon.
A poll too, see if anybody
that'd be nice.
Was interested.
All right. That's all we've got for you this time around on Rule of Three. Thank you guys so much for listening. Like, actually, thank you. It's
we
really cool
love
that you
so much.
Yeah,
more than you know.
And I hope you never forget about Timothy Dexter, because
I never will.
It's a legendary man. Again, his book is $7, so just go buy it. It's a beautiful thing that you should have in all your homes. Every American citizen should
every
have
coffee
one.
Table.
A pickle for the knowing
also,
ones.
Also, if you buy it, you can read along with us.
That's true. We can have a read-along.
Oh, yeah. So cute.
So when we stroke out, you can stroke out.
Also, thank you to Anchor for sponsoring this episode, too. It's been really great working with them, so, you know,
you might have
cool
peeped our ad in our episodes.
Yeah. The script for the follow-through on Aaron Brockovich is also underway, so hopefully that's going to be getting posted sometime next week-ish, around then.
Next week-ish.
Yeah, that'll be fun. Go give us a follow on Instagram at RuleOf3333, on Facebook at RuleOf3Podcast, and make sure you leave a rating and a review. Thank you, everybody, for listening. We'll be back in your ears next week. Goodbye, everybody.
Bye, guys.